welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 15th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and from the front page of today's Gazette, spring planting has sprung in eastern Iowa. Costs of fertilizer and other inputs rise, so has price of corn, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. In a normal spring, it might take 3 weeks for the first tiny corn shoots to rise from the ground, but how about just 1 week? That's what Mark Heckman, 58, of West Liberty, was expecting for the corn he planted during the recent heat wave. Days of 80 and 90 degrees, coupled with enough soil moisture from early May rains, should give the corn seed perfect conditions to germinate quickly, he said. I don't know if I've ever planted at 90 degrees and ample moisture, he said. It will probably be out of the ground in 3 days. It's almost as if Mother Nature is making up for a lost time after a cold, wet spring that delayed corn planting statewide by 2 weeks, according to Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship's May 9th crop report. Soybean planting was 12 days behind schedule. It's just another example of the hurry up and wait, or this year, wait and hurry up, nature of farming. Heckman, who grows corn and soybeans with his brothers Kent Heckman and Kurt Heckman, as part of a family operation, has had to keep his anxiety in check this spring. It's ingrained in you that you want to get as much sunlight so these crops can perform at their best, he said. But he was riding his Case IH planter last Tuesday night, t-shirt covered with dust, earbuds in to hear the phone and eyes on the planter's computer screen, which tells him the density of seed in each row, soil compaction, and the distance between each row. The planter can be programmed to cut off seed and fertilizer when the planter crosses a waterway, which reduces waste and water pollution. A beeping sound lets him know when he's getting close to the end of a row. There are more microprocessors on this planter than there probably were on the rocket that went to the moon, he said. Working with, not against, the land is important to Heckman, who is active in Practical Farmers of Iowa, a nonprofit that seeks to advance farming that is profitable, ecologically sound, and that enhances the community. One of the organization's priorities is promoting use of cover crop. Rye, wheat, and oats, grown between crops of corn and soybeans, have been shown to reduce fertilizer runoff, shore up soil, and sequester carbon dioxide. Still, only a sliver of farmers, 4.2% of Iowa farm acres in 2019, plant cover crops. But Heckman is a believer. He and his family grow rye on all their acres because it increases organic matter in the soil over time. The rye grows over the winter and spring before the Heckmans kill it off before planting corn and beans. It's in the process of dying, he said of the cover crop. It will act as a mulch or cover for the corn or bean crop. The cost of a farmer's raw materials, seed, fertilizer, and equipment, have gone up this year. The price of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer alone tripled from January 2021 to March 2022, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reported. The Iowa Attorney General is working with economists to try to figure out why these prices have skyrocketed, especially when Iowa has several fertilizer plants. One of the factors is Russia, the world's largest fertilizer producer, reducing exports because of international sanctions over the war in Ukraine, the Wall Street Journal reported. But with corn prices over $8 a bushel, the highest price seen since August 2012, farmers are poised to make good money in 2022. One of the bigger functions that agriculture has is we've got the ability to feed and fuel this country, Heckman said. He supports plans to build pipelines to sequester carbon dioxide from Iowa ethanol plants, although he knows many farmers oppose companies seeking to use eminent domain to gain easements for the pipelines. For years, we have taken crude out of the ground, and 50% of what we've taken out of the ground is carbon, he said. These pipelines have the ability to very efficiently put twice as much carbon back into the ground. Heckman expects to finish planting by Friday. Everybody wants to hurry, hurry, hurry to get done, he said, but once you're all done, then you're like, what more can we do? Also from the front page, Independence honors seamen killed in Pearl Harbor, by Emily Anderson of the Gazette in Independence. More than 80 years after seaman David F. Tidball died aboard the USS Oklahoma when it sank during the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, he was buried Saturday in a military service in his hometown of Independence. Not many of the deceased from the USS Oklahoma were able to be identified after the war, but in 2015, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency disinterred the unidentified bodies and began the process of identification through anthropological analysis, mitochondrial DNA, and Y-chromosome DNA. Tidball's body was identified in 2021. He graduated from Independence High School in 1938 and received a diploma from Independence Community College in spring 1940. That summer, he enlisted in the Navy. Tidball, who died when he was 20, has been in the Navy about a year before Japanese torpedoes struck the ship. He was one of 429 USS Oklahoma crewmen who died in the attack. Tidball's remains arrived Saturday at the Mount Hope Cemetery behind a procession of 58 motorcyclists from veteran and motorcycle groups in northeast Iowa. Flags lined the road into the cemetery, and community members surrounded the site where Tidball would be buried. Family members, mostly nieces and nephews, sat in a few chairs by the casket during the graveside service. A eulogy was delivered by Naval Captain Mark Dieter, who came from Wisconsin for the funeral, but is originally from Vinton. Seaman Tidball was honored by a 21-gun salute performed by naval cadets from the Naval Station Great Lakes. "This is not just a day about a family. It's also a day about our nation. It's about our nation's history," Dieter said during his remarks. "The greatest error we can make as a nation is not to be grateful." Tidball's family was presented with the flag that had adorned his casket by Naval Commanding Officer Shahama Brown. Brown said before the service that it's a sacred honor to be in attendance at veteran funerals. "This is the second time she's been present as a service for a USS Oklahoma seaman. You don't know them, but they're still your brother or sister, because you wear that uniform too," Brown said. Harry E. Nichols, a Navy storekeeper from Sioux City, was also identified as part of the accounting agency project and was buried Friday in Sioux City. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered flags across the state to fly at half-staff Friday and Saturday to honor Nichols and Tidball. Before his body was identified, Tidball had been honored in Independence as the first local serviceman to lose his life in World War II. The American Legion Sheehan Tidball Post 30 was named for Tidball and for Captain E.M. Sheehan, the first serviceman to lose his life in World War I. Members of the American Legion and other veterans organizations stood at attention throughout the service Saturday. And from the Iowa Today section and Iowa Profile, Mother of Two gives $1 million to Iowa City School Foundation by Grace King of the Gazette in Iowa City. A mother of two, giving with warm hands, has donated $1 million to the Iowa City Community School District Foundation, hoping her gift will encourage others to donate money while they're still alive to see the impact. "I wanted to inspire other people to make these larger commitments to the level they're able to," Boge said. Boge's gift will go toward closing opportunity gaps and supporting students in need. Her gift is the largest donation in the foundation's 40-year history and will be awarded in $50,000 installments over the next 20 years. "Sometimes it's easier not to go to school," Boge said. "We want it to be easy for children to go to school every day, if that means making sure they have clean clothes, effective transportation, are well fed," she said. "There's a lot of things that need to happen before learning." She said her decision to make the gift was influenced by seeing young parents at Tate High School, Iowa City's alternative high school, balance schoolwork and caring for a child. "I'm a single mother, but I have every advantage in the world, and it's still hard," Boge said. "I can't imagine being 17 years old with a baby trying to stay in school. That was someone I needed to help." While Boge, 48, wants to give her children every opportunity, she doesn't want to create a disincentive to work, she said. "I want them to be hardworking and learn to support themselves. Giving gifts like this ensures my kids will need to work hard like I did," said Boge, whose daughter, Dolores, is a seventh grader at Northwest Junior High, and son, Grayson, is a fifth grader at Willowwind, a private school in Iowa City. Grayson previously attended Wickham Elementary in the Iowa City District. Boge, originally from rural Farley in Dubuque County, has lived in Iowa City since she was 18 when she enrolled at the University of Iowa. She has a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's in business administration. She has worked at Integrated DNA Technologies in Coralville since 1995, where she started as a production scientist. In a series of executive roles, she professionalized the company's supply chain and logistics, according to her company bio. She has been the company's senior vice president of global operations since 2021. Boge, a member of the Iowa City School Foundation's board, also served on the state board of Iowa Innovation Council. No decisions have been made on how Boge's gift will be used. The needs of students 20 years from now, she said, could be very different from their needs today. And that is Christine Boge. I don't know that the article ever gave her first name. Christine Boge is shown in a photograph with her son, Grayson, accompanying this article. Turning to the Iowa Today and a Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Adult Court. A judge ruled last week that two Fairfield juveniles, Willard Noble Chaden Miller, 16, and Jeremy Everett Goodale, 17, will be tried in adult court in the November slaying of Fairfield High School Spanish teacher Nohima Graber, 66. The two are charged with first-degree murder, accused of attacking Graber as she was walking in a Fairfield park and concealing her body beneath a tarp. The attorneys representing them asked that their cases be heard in juvenile court. But 8th Judicial District Judge Sean Showers, in his ruling, said there is not enough time for rehabilitation in the juvenile court system and that probable cause exists to charge the two with premeditated murder. Goodale's trial is set for August 23rd, and Miller's trial is set for November 1st. Country Club Project. Five members of the Cedar Rapids City Council on Tuesday tabled consideration of a Cedar Rapids Country Club expansion project to give the club more time to address neighbor concerns. Four of the council members determined they had conflicts of interest and did not join in the discussion or vote on the project. The council vote delays the club's plans to expand over seven residential lots and potentially vacate the Fairway Terrace Southeast right-of-way so it can develop a tennis complex and courts, expand the club's parking lot, and modify the driving range. Trooper slaying. Final arguments are scheduled for Monday in the first-degree murder trial of Michael Thomas Lang, 42, accused in the April 2021 slaying of Iowa State Patrol Sergeant Jim Smith, 51. Lang shot Smith as law enforcement officials were attempting to arrest Lang, who'd assaulted a police officer earlier in the day. Prosecutors said officers gave Lang plenty of opportunity to surrender before entering his house in Grundy Center. Lang's lawyer told jurors the trooper's death was tragic but did not amount to murder. Under the heading, they said, "Yeah, guys, we're not really looking to taste memories of the Dust Bowl here." Saturday Night Live actor Mikey Day playing a Blue Bunny employee in a skit spoofing the Iowa-based ice cream maker. And I want my own AG, Attorney General, please. And I need a state auditor that's not trying to sue me every time they turn around. Focus on your own office. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, in a video posted by WHO TV Channel 13 News. And she wants a lap dog. Keep your watchdog here. State Auditor Rob Sand, a Democrat, in a tweet responding to Reynolds. Under the heading Odds and Ends, SOFA lawsuit. A legal dispute is unfolding in Polk County District Court over who owns the sofas in the Iowa Governor's Mansion in Des Moines. The nonprofit Terrace Hill Society Foundation is suing the Terrace Hill Commission, the state agency responsible for maintaining the mansion in Des Moines, over ownership and control of the furnishings and other items at Terrace Hill. The foundation says it has received hundreds of donated items in the past 50 years and worked closely with the commission to place items and artifacts in the mansion, built in 1869. It accused the commission of seizing control of the collection in recent years. Crypto in Iowa. The Grundy County Board of Supervisors on Monday voted 4-1 to not rezone land to allow construction of the second cryptocurrency mining site in the county. They told the mining store CEO, J.P. Barrick, they weren't opposed to the expansion, but wanted a different location. The current cryptocurrency site, a Quonset hut stacked with computers, is one of the first, if not the first, such site in Iowa. It operates next to Grundy County Rural Electric Co-op Power Station and uses more electricity than all the residential customers in Grundy Center, the county seat of 2,800 population. Under the heading, The Water Cooler, Doggone, the Iowa Greyhound Park in Dubuque will close this month after 41 years. By year's end, there will only be two dog tracks left in the country. Jayhawks win national academic title. A team from Cedar Rapids Jefferson High School won the Division II National Academic Decathlon. Teams from the school have won 22 consecutive state academic decathlons, which test student knowledge in 10 areas. Beer and Deer. Deer & Company and Anheuser-Busch have partnered to put out a limited edition run of green beer cans, which feature machinery and the Deer Company logo. For each case sold, both corporations will donate $1 to Farm Rescue, a nonprofit that assists farm and ranch families who experience a major illness, injury, or natural disaster. Under the heading, More in the News, Pearl Harbor Burial, Seaman First Class David Tidball, who died aboard the USS Oklahoma during the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, was buried in Mount Hope Cemetery in Independence. No Abortion Bill. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said she does not expect abortion-related legislation to be passed during current legislative session, which is close to adjourning. Reynolds told reporters state officials plan to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling this summer on Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that legalized abortion and then determine a path forward in Iowa. Prom party shooting. Three Iowa teenagers were shot and injured after uninvited guests showed up to an after-prom party in Des Moines. Police said about 200 people were at the party before the shooting was reported around 12:30 a.m. last Sunday. Two 18-year-old boys and a 17-year-old girl were wounded. And a January 6th arrest. A 41-year-old Iowa man faces charges alleging he took part in the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Chad Heathcote of Adel is charged with two felonies. In charging documents, an FBI agent said witnesses came forward after Heathcote bragged on social media about being at the Capitol that day. Turning to the Insight page and a couple of columns about E15 under the heading High Octane Discussion. The first column is from Aaron Smith. Aaron Smith is a professor of agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis. Smith writes, E15 fuel year-round, a symbolic victory. As part of efforts to dampen high gasoline prices, the Biden administration is temporarily allowing gas stations to sell a special fuel blend called E15, containing 15% ethanol year-round. Under the Clean Air Act, E15 cannot be sold in summer because it evaporates more rapidly in warm weather and can worsen air pollution. Where is E15 and where is it used? Ethanol, also known as ethyl alcohol or grain alcohol, has long been a potential alternative to gasoline. Henry Ford advocated for it in the 1920s, but it wasn't used much until the early 2000s because it was too expensive. More than 93% of the ethanol currently made in the U.S. comes from corn. In 2007, amid concerns about high gas prices, energy security, and climate change, Congress passed a law creating a renewable fuel standard, which requires transportation fuels sold in the U.S. each year to contain certain quantities of biofuels, like ethanol and biodiesel. Under this policy, more than 95% of all gasoline sold in the United States is E10, a blend of 90% gasoline and 10% ethanol. E15 contains 15% ethanol and 85% gasoline. It is currently available in about 2,300 of the 145,000 gas stations in the United States, mainly in Midwestern states, where most corn is grown and processed into ethanol. E15 is more corrosive than E10, so some drivers worry that it will damage their engines. The Environmental Protection Agency has approved E15 for use in any light-duty vehicle of model year 2001 or newer, and many car makers have approved of it for use in their cars in the past decade. Some automakers recommend against using E15. It is not approved for use in motorcycles, heavy-duty vehicles such as buses and delivery trucks, boats, or equipment such as lawnmowers. The prohibition on selling E15 in summer stemmed from the EPA's efforts to reduce smog, which can cause respiratory problems in people who breathe it. Ironically, E15 has very similar smog-causing potential to the E10 it would replace, but a set of arcade rules from the 1970s has banned E15 while allowing E10. One source of smog is evaporating gasoline, and evaporation rates are highest in the heat of summer. To reduce summer evaporative emissions, the EPA set seasonal limits for gasoline's reed vapor pressure, a measure of its evaporation potential. The EPA requires summer gasoline to have an RVP less than 9 pounds per square inch. Regular summer gasoline without ethanol has an RVP of 9, but summer E10 and E15 both have RVPs around 10. This would seem to preclude both E10 and E15. However, in 1978, during a previous energy crisis, Congress issued an allowance specifically for E10. That's why E10 gasoline can be sold year-round. Some regions require even lower reed vapor pressure, including areas with severe ozone pollution that are required to use reformulated gasoline. Fuel that is formulated to burn more cleanly than conventional gasoline, with fewer smog-forming and toxic pollutants. California has its own tight standards. Research shows that requiring clean gasoline dramatically improves air quality and health. Will more use of E15 affect gas prices? No, it won't. The Biden administration stated in mid-April that E15 could save drivers 10 cents per gallon on average. That's hardly enough to compensate for the fact that cars running on E15 get 1% to 2% fewer miles per gallon than those burning E10. However, very little of it is likely to be sold. This is not the first time we've had summer E15. The Trump administration allowed it to be sold during the summer in 2019-21, but gas stations sold very little of it. In 2021, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled that in lifting the seasonal restriction, Trump's EPA had overstepped its legal authority. The Biden administration believes it is on firmer legal footing because it is authorizing E15 under an emergency waiver due to a fuel supply emergency caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in a counterpoint, we have from Darren Wilson. Darren Wilson, president of the Iowa Ethanol Producers Association and general manager of Poet Bioprocessing in Emmitsburg, writes, energy independence continues with E15. Finally, a bipartisan solution both parties embrace. Global events drive global markets, and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia highlights how quickly world affairs can jeopardize the flow of affordable energy. Now more than ever, America needs to assert its energy independence, and homegrown biofuels are a critical step to help us get there. We may not get there overnight, but Iowa continues to move us forward. Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa legislature are leading a national shift to guarantee the freedom to fuel up with E15. On the federal front, E15 will be available throughout 2022 after President Joe Biden announced in Iowa last month a waiver to allow summertime use of the low-carbon, low-cost fuel. The world's dependence on Russian oil and gas casts an ominous shadow over the global recovery. It hamstrung early efforts to deter Putin's aggression and hampered attempts to cut off Russian crude from the West. Leaders in the U.S. and Europe still fear collateral damage from energy sanctions. The U.S. imports millions of barrels of Russian oil, and changes in global energy prices are already hitting American families. This past week, gas prices hit new all-time highs once again. In her response to the March State of the Union address, Governor Reynolds stressed that states like Iowa recognize the critical importance of this issue. She says that is why we're fighting to restore America's energy independence, including biofuels. Governor Reynolds is right. We have allowed ourselves to become far too dependent on energy supplies from our enemies for far too long. We've made amazing strides over the last few decades, but America's heartland remains largely untapped in meeting its full potential as a producer of homegrown transportation fuel. Biofuels currently provide about 10% of the U.S. fuel supply, but they could offer so much more. Energy security is national security. A strong domestic market for biofuel insulates us from market price shocks when markets are unstable, and it gives us greater flexibility when dealing with hostile nations. Governor Reynolds' bioethanol bill, HF 2128, takes us one crucial step closer to achieving energy security and lowering fuel costs by guaranteeing access across the state to E15, a 15% biofuel blend by 2026. With the new standard in place, we expect more stations will make the shift much sooner. Moving our nation from E10 to E15 would offset 6.2 billion gallons of gasoline, support more jobs across the heartland, and provide many other significant economic benefits across the U.S. economy. The latest analysis shows that nationwide E15 would add $17.8 billion to U.S. GDP and save the average household $100 annually at the pump. Because E15 is approved for use in 9 out of 10 cars on the road today, it's also a solution that works for essentially everyone. The economic benefits are even greater for states that produce biofuels, and as the nation's single largest supplier of American-made energy, Iowa stands to gain the most from E15. In Iowa alone, shifting from E10 to E15 would save consumers a combined total of $134 million annually at the pump. It would grow Iowa's GDP by $95.4 million and support almost 4,000 jobs. Best of all, the new value creation from E15 would flow back to Iowa farmers and rural workers instead of ending up in Russia or other oil-rich nations. Gazette editorial fellow Althea Cole writes, "I hate ranked choice voting." Disclaimer, the opinions expressed in this column are those of its author and do not represent the views or opinions of the Linn County Auditor's Office. In June 2020, an elderly voter came to my polling place intent on voting against Donald Trump. It was a primary election, and presidential races do not appear on primary ballots in Iowa. Confused, the elderly voter started sobbing. The electorate consists of voters ranging greatly in age, ability, and knowledge of the process. The best way to keep that process accessible to voters who may struggle cognitively is to keep the ballot uncomplicated. Ranked choice voting, which is currently being considered by a working group from the Cedar Rapids Charter Review Commission, is not an uncomplicated process. For that reason, I detest it. Ranked choice voting, or RCV as it's abbreviated, is the process of electing candidates by ranking them in order of a voter's preference. If no candidate receives a majority, 50% plus one, of first preference votes, the candidate with the lowest number of votes is eliminated. Voters who rank that candidate as their first choice instantly have their second choice counted instead. The process repeats until a candidate receives a clear majority and is declared the winner. If you had to reread that a few times or consult another resource to understand it, you've made my point. Now imagine reading about ranked choice voting in the instructions of the ballot you're about to cast to make your picks for municipal leadership. Currently, in the event that a city candidate does not receive a majority of the vote on election day, Cedar Rapids requires a runoff election to be held 4 weeks later. This is unlike most other elections, such as county, state, and federal, which are won with a plurality of votes. Avoiding that runoff is the basis of RCV's appeal among local proponents after mayoral races in 2017 and 2021 each required a runoff held after Thanksgiving to declare a winner. Costs associated with a runoff election weigh heavily on both candidates and taxpayers. Candidates who advance to a runoff must raise enough cash to sustain an additional 28 days of campaigning. Taxpayers foot the bill for polling locations, paying $100,506 in costs associated with the 2021 runoff. Future runoff elections could theoretically cost more, as the 2021 runoff used a reduced number of polling places due to pandemic-related staffing issues. Saving that money can come at a cost to voters who risk losing confidence in a confusing process. Misunderstanding of the RCV method could lead to a higher rate of ballot spoiling due to incorrect marking. Voters who rank only some candidates and leave the rest blank won't have a say in subsequent rounds of vote tabulations if their ranked candidates are eliminated before a winner is declared. Voters who find certain candidates particularly distasteful, apparently that's happened before, and rank them lower still risk accidentally voting to elect one of those candidates if counting continues to those later rounds. Voter education is the most difficult part of that, said Matt Warfield, Deputy Commissioner of Elections in Linn County. Election officials such as myself also will need to be properly trained if we are to assist those voters when they come to us with questions. I can only speak for myself and not the entire pool of precinct election officials who serve Linn County, but I can't help but wonder, if a self-described smart girl like me needs hours of research to understand it, how might voters who don't fancy themselves a policy wonk adapt? Cedar Rapids voters shouldn't prepare for such a steep learning curve just yet. As of now, ranked choice voting remains a process that can't even be legally implemented. State law does not prescribe a process for RCV in any type of election. Voters deserve a clean, simple ballot with clean, simple instructions. Ranked choice voting will never be a clean or simple process, and for that reason alone, I can't say it enough. I hate ranked choice voting. Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, School Litter Box Fever Will Not Die in Iowa. Iowa is being plagued by multiple cases of what I'm diagnosing as a strain of cat scratch fever. Symptoms include a fever, which is worsened by spending lots of time in conservative culture war fever swamps. There's also a loss of appetite for facts. But the clearest evidence you've been stricken is believing that public school districts in Iowa have placed litter boxes in school bathrooms to accommodate kids identifying as animals. I wish I were making this up. As for the rest of us, expect headaches, confusion, and exhaustion. And despite the best efforts of the reality-based community to find a cure, the condition continues to spread. The truth has been declawed. I received an email last Saturday morning from a guy I know in Fort Dodge dating back to my time at the Fort Dodge Messenger. Ernie Kirsten had been at the Eggs and Issues Legislative Forum in Fort Dodge, where State Senator Tim Crayenbrink, Republican Fort Dodge, went on a curious riff about why Iowa needs to offer publicly funded scholarships to help families send kids to private school. Crayenbrink said a school district in his Senate district put litter boxes in bathrooms to accommodate furries. He also pointed to an unidentified school district where he said girls are wearing one-piece bathing suits to shower because boys are infiltrating their showers. Are you hearing similar nonsense? Kirsten asked. Yeah, unfortunately. Sure enough, the messenger was on the scene at Eggs and Issues to report on the senator's thoughts. Not in the Fort Dodge district, but in my Senate district, they're requiring these schools to put cat litter boxes in the bathroom, Crayenbrink said. According to the messenger's Kelby Wingert. The thing is, these things are happening in Iowa on a regular basis and nobody knows about it because the media doesn't cover these things. Of course, the media is keeping Littergate secret. It's a catspiracy. By the way, this is one of the 32 Republican senators guiding public policy in Iowa, not your nutty cousin on Facebook. Naturally, Wingert wanted to know which school district the senator was referring to. Using cat-like political reflexes, Crayenbrink tried to scratch some litter to cover up the mess he made. In a text message on Sunday, Crayenbrink told the messenger he found out about the litter boxes during a confidential conversation, and he does not feel comfortable identifying the district. Also, the litter boxes don't exist. The same story has been debunked elsewhere in Iowa and in Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It's been circulating since last year and won't die. And why is that? Well, it's instructive to note that before Crayenbrink went on his flight of feline fancy, he was talking about the Linmar School Board's recent decision to pull together its existing policies for supporting transgender students into a cohesive plan that follows state and federal law. Linmar's entirely reasonable decision has become the latest target of the recklessly unreasonable and perpetually outraged. Bathrooms, locker rooms. Crayenbrink and other conservatives are working overtime to prove allowing transgender kids to live authentically in a safe school environment puts us on a path toward societal collapse. What's next? Well, litter boxes, apparently. So the litter box stories are part of an effort to smear transgender kids and justify restricting their rights. It's a slippery slope covered with culture war slime. The solution, obviously, is to take tens of millions of dollars from public schools and give it to private schools, because parents should be scared to send their kids to public schools. Why is damn near everything the GOP pushes anchored in manufactured fear? On Wednesday, Kreienbrink said he misspoke and apologized for miscommunication. I'm sort of surprised he didn't claim he's a victim of radical woke liberals and raise money. Kirsten initiated an effort to send the senator bags of kitty litter. Brilliant. Meanwhile, back in Marion at last week's Lynn Mar School Board meeting, board member Matt Rollinger, who opposes the district's transgender policies, got an earful from fellow board members about his attendance at a closed-door meeting with Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. The meeting called together opponents of the transgender policy to discuss their misguided opposition in a comfortable setting, without pesky media or parents, such as myself, who support the district's move. He didn't inform his colleagues or the district about the meeting. Rollinger, according to Gazette education reporter Grace King, insisted he was not there as a representative of the school board. I very specifically said I am here speaking on my own behalf, Rollinger said. So he wasn't wearing his school board hat at the meeting. Maybe he was wearing the Joe and the Ho Gotta Go hat he sported in a photo circulated on social media during last year's school board campaign. King reported that state guidance on transgender student equity has disappeared from the Department of Education website. Odd. Seriously, folks, this sad spectacle is demoralizing and exhausting. Consider the message it sends transgender kids. Instead of seeking more understanding about their lives and approaching these issues with empathy and an open mind, the leaders of their state are spitting venom, stoking divisions, and embracing nonsense. These kids are not a threat. They just want to live their lives and go to school without fear of abuse. As I've said, we should just put away the chants, flags, and signs and leave them alone. Leave them alone. Remember how right-wing culture crusaders said same-sex marriage would destroy society and bring on rampant polygamy? I do. They were wrong then and they're wrong now. All these harmful, spiteful tactics targeting Iowans and their rights for a political payday carry an unmistakable stench. They should be tossed into the litter box of history. And today's community letters and cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller of Green Bay, a four-panel cartoon. The first panel has a man driving past road construction signs. It's road construction season. Relax, you've got this. He's still in the road construction with single lane ahead and expect delays. Sure, you'll be stuck in traffic much, much longer. Just chill. In the third panel, there's a sign that says 23-mile detour ahead. And you'll probably drive a lot farther, but it's okay. In the last panel, it says, as long as you've got a tank full of gas. He's very angry and he's next to a gas station with a large dollar sign on the gas pump. The first letter today is from Keith Berg of Marion. If Iowa policies are bad, what's the alternative? I read with interest the April 24th guest column, I used to be proud to be an Iowan. I have only one question. If Democrats were to offer policy solutions to help Iowa prosper, what policies would you offer? Let's consider three states that are managed by Democrats, and maybe we can find one that matches the direction you want to go. Consider California, Illinois, and New York. We find large governments with higher taxes and debt. In Iowa, we have a balanced budget, reduced taxes, and no debt. Those states have violent crime on the rise, violent criminals being let out on the street, and bail reform that placates the criminal. We see homelessness with human waste and needles scattered on the streets. Are these policies you would offer to Iowa? We see 8% plus inflation, interest rates on the rise, our 401ks tanking due to the high inflation, and our energy independence being destroyed, forcing us to buy oil from dictators and terrorists. We see immigration turn loose with crime, drugs, and death entering our nation with no control. Consider our school systems. The educational system in our country is ineffective. Public education in U.S. is ranked 25th globally. Personally, I have not seen anything in Democratic-run states that would entice me to bring those policies to Iowa. The solutions will not come from bigger government, but by our people working together. So which policies would you offer? Keith Berg of Marion. Next letter is from Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. Opponents of LGBTQ policy feign victimhood. The Lynn Mar School Board deserves high praise for standing up for fear-mongering and misinformation in order to protect some of its most vulnerable students. In an extraordinary feat of mental gymnastics, opponents of the district's policy regarding LGBTQ students tried to paint themselves as victims. In reality, numerous studies have shown members of the LGBTQ community are particularly susceptible to harassment, bullying, and assault. Opponents showed their true colors at a recent rally when they waved "Don't Tread on Me" and Crusader flags, both of which have been embraced by far-right extremist groups. Members of militia groups and white supremacists waved them at the January 6th assault on the Capitol. On top of this, Governor Kim Reynolds and Representative Ashley Hinson fanned the flames by meeting secretly with opponents recently. Despite such acrimony, the district is standing for all its students, a mission that's unique to public schools. Perhaps that inclusivity is what makes far-right extremists so determined to destroy them. Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. And finally, Robert Taylor of Cedar Rapids writes, "Why choose hate when you can choose love? Why is it so hard for people to live with joy and love instead of misery and hate? This question has plagued me over the last decade of division in our country. Love and hate are a choice we all make. Call me an idealist, but I believe our path to healing begins with choosing love and joy over hate and misery. The moment we encounter someone or something that makes us uncertain or uncomfortable, we make our choice. We can either choose curiosity and wonder, or we can choose anger and fear. Hate is controlling and addicting. We have so little control over the world around us, it can feel good to express anger toward others. But this is a hollow and miserable form of control, fearful and lonely. Choosing hate is cowardice. Love is rewarding, healing, and spiritual. Philosophers and artists throughout history exalted love. It is a central tenet of nearly all world religions. Love fills us with joy and gives us hope for the future. It strengthens the bonds we share with one another. Love isn't always obvious or easy, but it is essential. Choosing love is courage. We all face this choice every day. Choosing love can be challenging. We all know how hard it is to love people we see as enemies, but loving the humanity of others is crucial, especially when it's difficult. What is your path to choosing love? Are you courageous enough to follow it?" Robert Taylor of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 15, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, dealing with laryngitis, and I'm sorry you have to listen to that. We turn to today's obituaries. Larry R. Clore of Cedar Rapids. There will be a celebration of life from 5 to 8 p.m. May 20th at Parlor City in Nubo to socialize with drinks and appetizers. Larry passed from complications of heart surgery. Larry was a private pilot and spent many hours in the cockpit. He enjoyed fishing in Canada with his son and friends, breakfast of lunch with the guys, and he rode and ride by, skied in Colorado, and played tennis for many years at Elmcrest. Harry Leonard Cross, age 92, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with the Lord on Thursday, May 5th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 17th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 18th, with the visitation beginning 1 hour prior at St. Pius X Catholic Church. After high school, Harry enlisted in the U.S. Navy during the Korean conflict. He attended DeVry Technical Institute in Chicago, training to be an electronic technologist, and he worked for 37 years at Rockwell Collins. Patricia Jean Downing, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, May 11th, at Mercy Medical Center. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m. Monday, May 16th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will immediately follow at 3 p.m. at the funeral home. Patricia was a member of the Eagles Club Auxiliary and the Moose Lodge. Dorothy May Grendler, age 87, a lifelong resident of Cedar Rapids, received her wings on Monday, May 9th. Private family services will be held at a later date. Dorothy enjoyed working in her garden, visiting family and friends, cooking large meals for the holidays with her children and grandchildren all up in her way, as she would say. She also loved putting together puzzles and watching her beloved Westerns. Peggy Joan Heyman, born Peggy Joan Higgins, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 31st. Peggy was active with the First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Falls, teaching Sunday school. She served as a deacon and community outreach for the church, and she volunteered for Girl Scouts and was den mother for PAC 55, Den 7. She enjoyed hosting large gatherings with family and friends in her home. She was the epitome of the hostess with the mostess. Peggy will be put to rest at Rush Lake Cemetery in Curlew alongside her husband. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 17th, followed by a luncheon at the Methodist Church in Lawrence. Ora Lee Hollingsworth, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away May 4th. A memorial visitation will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 21st, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A memorial service will begin at 11 a.m. Interment of cremains will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Ora Lee worked for many years at Kirkwood Community College. After retirement, Ora Lee enjoyed playing cards with her friends, going out to eat, playing bingo, and meeting up with her longtime friends. Marjorie L. Kielkoff, known as Marge, age 89, originally of Ottumwa and a longtime resident of Cedar Rapids, passed away of natural causes on May 10th at her home in Santan Valley, Arizona. Marge was one of the first girls in Iowa to be a newspaper carrier, delivering the Des Moines Register and collecting payment from 147 families. For that effort, she won a trip to Chicago and a flight in a Piper Cub. She was a lifelong fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes and Chicago Cubs. She also helped Bill lead the Southeast Iowa Square Dance Club in the 1950s and worked several factory jobs, retiring from Quaker Oats in Cedar Rapids, where her bosses called her the hardest worker they ever had. According to Marge's wishes, there will be no public celebration of life. Raymond W. Beamer, age 76, of Iowa City, died Thursday, December 23, 2021, at UIHC. A time for family and friends to gather to celebrate Ray's life will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, May 22nd, at the Finkbein Nagel Family Clubhouse at 1380 Melrose Avenue in Iowa City. Richard Stuland, known as Dick, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, May 10th, at the Circle of Life Hospice Center in Bentonville, Arkansas. A memorial service for Dick will be held at 11:30 a.m. Monday, May 16th, at the Fayetteville National Cemetery in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Dick enlisted in the U.S. Marines and proudly fought for the freedom of others in the Korean War. Dick worked for Iowa Electric until his retirement in 1991. The greatest loves of his life were his family, his God, his country, his buddies, and being part of the Model A Restorers and Antique Automobile Clubs. Marilyn Jane Lent of Coralville passed away Monday, May 9th, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. She was born in 1948. Marilyn worked for Rockwell Collins for over 30 years and retired 5 years ago. Funeral will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Saturday, May 21st at 2 p.m., with visitation beginning at 1 p.m. until service time. Mom's favorite color was purple. If you would like to add some purple to what you wear, that would be great. Tony Tripp Reimer of Iowa City, a life so beautiful and filled with joy deserves special celebration. Please join us as we honor our beloved mother, grandmother, educator, and friend, Tony Tripp Reimer, who passed away on December 13th, 2021. The family will host a celebration of her life from noon to 4 p.m. with remarks at 2 p.m., May 21st at 1630 North Dubuque Road in Iowa City. A.W. Martin, age 95, of Fayette, died Saturday, December 25th, 2021, at Maple Crest Manor in Fayette. Memorial services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Sunday, May 29th, at the First United Methodist Church in Fayette, with Reverend Jim Dale officiating. Graveside service with military rites will be held at 4 p.m. Sunday at Lima Cemetery, rural Wadena. Visitation will precede services of the church on Sunday, starting at 12:30 p.m. Besides farming, A.W. was a 4-H leader, school board member, Republican Party county chairman, a certified lay leader for the United Methodist Church, and served on many local and state church committees. He was proud to have served on the National Swine Registry Board for 6 years, 1 year as president. Arnold Schwerz, age 76, of Manchester, formerly of Shell Rock, passed away Sunday, May 8th, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. Visitation for Arnold will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 20th, at the St. Patrick Hall, Ryan Gymnasium in Ryan. Funeral service will follow at 11 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Ryan, with the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Interment will follow at Calvary Cemetery, Ryan, with military rites. Bone and Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Manchester is in charge of arrangements. Arnold served his country in the United States Army and was stationed in Germany during Vietnam. He held many jobs in construction until retiring from Spahn and Rose Lumber in Waverly. Arnold was a devout Catholic. He enjoyed watching TV, especially the History Channel and Dateline, and loved spending time outdoors and working on building and construction projects. Dr. Ralph Herman Rudy, 78, formerly of the Amana Colonies, passed away Saturday, May 7th in Staunton, Virginia at Brightview Baldwin Park. Memorial service will be conducted at 2 p.m. Sunday, May 22nd at Trinity Episcopal Church in Staunton, with the Reverend William A.J. Hine officiating. Ronald Leroy Hunt, age 67, left this life on Sunday, May 1st, in the woods at Redbrush, where he lived his solitary life with his cats nearby. A celebration of life will be held to honor him from 4:30 to 8 p.m. Saturday, June 18th, at the Pleasant Creek South Pavilion by the boat dock. Ron was a simple but wise man, gentle at heart, who lived close to nature. He walked his earth looking for amazing rocks for his collection, or deer antlers for his knife handles, and of course, those majestic morels. Nancy Lynn Kellogg, born Nancy Lynn O'Connor, age 81, a longtime resident of Cedar Rapids and recently of Woodbury, Minnesota, passed away peacefully on April 27, 2022, with family at her side. Nancy was a lifelong avid reader, enjoyed knitting and crocheting projects, listening to big band and other music from the 40s and 50s, as well as country music from all decades, and raising all sorts of houseplants as well as her children. She enjoyed watching classic movies, as well as Harry Potter movies, and working on crossword puzzles. Nancy was always a quiet, private, and reserved individual, and the family is respecting her wishes, and there is no memorial service planned at this time. Lisa Ann Price, born Lisa Ann Engelking, age 63 of Vinton, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, May 11th, at her home in Vinton with her family by her side. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, May 19th at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton, with Reverend Kurt Brubaker officiating. Interment will be held at Salem Cemetery, Van Horn. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until service time on Thursday at the funeral home. Lisa collected bears and was a true animal lover. She also enjoyed puzzles in her spare time. She was a huge Dallas Cowboys fan. Janet Marr, born Janet Vilhauer, age 58, of Iowa City, passed away November 30, 2021. A celebration of life is planned from 1 to 5 p.m. Saturday, May 21st, at the Coralville Reservoir East Overlook Pavilion, number 3 and 4. Patricia Lillian Redding of Paso Robles, California. The Redding family and friends have lost a loving and extremely talented speech pathologist who had a big heart and contagious laugh. She also had a passion for pulling people together to help everyone solve a problem or gather friends and family for spirited conversation and good food. She was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. There will be a celebration of life in the late summer. Elizabeth Leona Stevenson, known as Betty, age 91, of Brighton, Colorado, passed away January 25th, 2022, at her home. Betty taught high school home economics for 32 years in Brighton, Colorado. She served on many committees in her church, college, and international farm youth exchange programs. After retiring from teaching, Betty worked with senior citizen programs and won many awards for her accomplishments. Her body was cremated per her wishes. Celebration of life services will be at 10:30 a.m. May 28th at the Lynn Dunn Memorial Building at the Lynn County Fairgrounds, Central City, Iowa. Reception will follow services. Her remains will be interred at Lafayette Cemetery. Arlo Burdett Ginther, age 97, of Hiawatha, passed away on Saturday, May 7th at his home. Visitation will take place from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, May 20th at Murdoch Funeral Home in Marion. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 21st at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. Burial will follow at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. Arlo served honorably in the U.S. Navy during World War II. He was the owner of Ginther's Furniture and Appliance in Marion. He enjoyed cooking, listening to music, and attending dances. Arlo especially loved woodworking. Kenneth David Patton, known as Kenny, age 54, of Fairfax, unexpectedly passed away on Wednesday, May 11th, at his home. Funeral mass, 10 a.m. Saturday, May 21st, at St. John 23rd Catholic Church by the Reverend Richmond Zecco. Burial, St. Patrick Cemetery in Fairfax. Friends may visit with the family on Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. at TN Funeral Home and Saturday after 9 a.m. at the church. Kenny was a combat engineer in the U.S. Army from 1986 to 89. Kenny was hardworking and loved working with the best friends he ever had at Cedar River Paper. He was proud of his 22-year career of turning trash into cash or garbage into gold and his promotion to Corps 2. He was a talented writer with a wonderful way with words. He enjoyed taking photos, playing bid euchre with family, and watching sports. He also took pride in his 8-plus years of sobriety and had the goal that his kids would never see him drink. Robert E. Calloway of Coralville. Family and friends will celebrate the life of Robert E. Calloway from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, May 21st, at Lensing Oak Hill Funeral Service, 210 Holiday Road in Coralville. Sarah Lynn Nyquist, age 67, of Scottsdale, Arizona, passed away on Thursday, May 5th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. with a brief moment of sharing starting at 5 p.m. Tuesday, May 17th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom in Cedar Rapids. Sarah was employed by Rockwell Collins in the finance organization until moving to Scottsdale. She was a member of the Bethany Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids and was a lifetime member of the American Quarter Horse Association. Above all else, Sarah's passion was owning and showing champion quartership horses. Travis Dwight Jameson, 44, of Monticello, passed away on Saturday, April 17th, of short illness, surrounded by friends and family at Jones Regional Hospital. Travis was self-employed and previously worked at L.L. Palin for 14-plus years. No services are listed. Turning to sports, The Last Dash by Mike Kloss. Dubuque's 37-year-old Greyhound track closes after today's program in Dubuque. There was a time when traffic jams were caused by cars either arriving or leaving what was then called Dubuque Greyhound Park. If you were in a certain lane when you were leaving and lived in Dubuque, Mike Brandon of Dubuque recalled, you'd be forced to go to Wisconsin and then turn around to go home. That was when the track averaged 2,856 customers per racing program in 1985, its initial season. The opening night had a crowd of 4,249, including Governor Terry Branstad. Before one of that evening's races, young men in white tuxedos led the Greyhounds to the starting box. There used to be a fancy restaurant here in the 80s and 90s with carpeted floors and white tablecloths and waitresses and waiters, Brandon said. Brandon and a lot of other people were here last Wednesday night at what is now called the Iowa Greyhound Park, part of Kew Casino. Racing seasons here used to go from early spring to November, but it's just a truncated month-long 2022 season that ends this afternoon. Then Greyhound racing will be done in Iowa for good. The track seating area was filled last Wednesday night, even with a 5:30 p.m. starting time for the racing. A lot of people who hadn't been to the track for a long time came back for one last visit, one last trifecta box. Nostalgia, said Brandon. If it had this support, it would never have to close, said Dubuque's Chris Fair. Her mother, Diana Fetkether, has worked at the track since 1989. This was inevitable. After this year, only two tracks in the nation will remain open. Both are in West Virginia. Not enough dogs would be available for Dubuque's track to sustain operations. Many of Dubuque's dogs had raced in Florida in the winter, but in 2018, Floridians voted by a whopping margin to outlaw wagering on Greyhound races. Florida had long been the hub of the industry. There were about 60 dog tracks in the U.S. when Iowa legalized pari-mutuel racing and the Dubuque facility opened. Florida had 11 open just a few years ago. Animal safety concerns brought the matter to a vote, but Greyhound racing began dying a slow death as other forms of gambling were legalized in Iowa and across the nation. The Dubuque track was eventually allowed to add slot machines, then the facility became a full-fledged casino. A vivid example Wednesday of how different things are in gambling-wise in 2022 compared to 1985 was seen on a casino TV screen here. An ESPN program had a graphic showing the betting odds on that night's Pittsburgh Penguins-New York Rangers NHL game. You could have wagered on that contest here at the casino sportsbook, or you could have stayed home and used your phone to place a legal bet. In 1985, the Dubuque Greyhound track was the sole place for legal gambling in Iowa. Then dog tracks opened in Waterloo and Council Bluffs. Horse racing track Prairie Meadows opened in 1989. Then gambling on riverboats began. The boats eventually were replaced by brick-and-mortar casinos. Legal sports betting started in 2019. But Greyhound racing was a big darn deal here for a while. Dubuque's economy was in the tank in 1985. The city got into the dog track business, and it was a gamble that paid off. Out-of-towners came to town. Many arrived in chartered buses from Illinois and Wisconsin to bet on dogs running up to 45 miles per hour for just over 30 seconds. You may not be able to imagine such a thing if you haven't attended a dog race. You may not be able to fathom a public address announcer saying, "Let's meet the athletes," as the dogs are walked to the track in the starting box. "Here comes Julian," the announcer will shout for the last time today, as the mechanical bone-shaped lure circles the track and eight greyhounds are released to pursue it. The lure is named in honor of Julian Dubuque, one of the first settlers of this area. The original Julian is long gone. Soon enough, his namesake will be as well. "It's the end of an era," said Brandon, who liked the Dubuque track for another reason. "I adopted a greyhound from here. I loved having it as a pet. It would run in the yard for 45 seconds and lay on the couch for 23 hours. And finally today, the time machine, Cedar Rapids Garage, became Times Theater. First Avenue Film Venue went from swanky to sleazy. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. The Times Movie Theater opened on Christmas Day in 1941 with seating for 670 patrons. The theater in the 1400 block of First Avenue East in Cedar Rapids had black lights to bring out the design of modernistic floral murals painted with fluorescent paint. In 45 years, it would go from swanky to sleazy, forced to close by changing zoning regulations. But first, the theater was a garage. In 1924, the six-story Commonwealth apartment building on 2nd Avenue Southeast was nearing completion. The Commonwealth Annex Board was formed to, among other things, build a fireproof garage at 1415 First Avenue Southeast for tenants to use. The garage had space to rent. In 1934, Rao Electric Company had its GM truck business there. In June 1937, Allen Motor Company manager Ray Allen announced his company would lease the garage. The top floor was a warehouse for new cars. Used cars were reconditioned on the first floor. The basement had 40 or 50 spaces where Commonwealth tenants could park their cars. The Commonwealth garage also housed an ambulance service for at least 3 years, beginning in 1936. A new ambulance, the finest between the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, in fact the only others like it are now in service at the two World's Fairs, was parked in the garage. The 16-cylinder LaSalle was moonstone gray with black fenders and trim. Its purchase was arranged after the city and Linn County agreed to pay $250 a month to maintain the ambulance service. The garage lasted until 1941, when a lawsuit forced it into foreclosure.
Illinois theater owner Kenneth Childs bought the property in July and made plans to turn it into a movie house. Moorhead Construction Company gutted the garage interior and replaced the concrete roof with a steel one. The front of the theater, designed by Chris Benson of Davenport, was ivory porcelain enameled steel with burgundy trim. John Paul Kubik was named the theater's manager, opening it on Christmas Day, 1941. He insisted on running the film projectors himself, which resulted in picketing by union members of the International Alliance of Theatrical State Employee and Motion Picture Machine Operators, Local 191, or AFL. Hal Sheridan took over as manager after leaving the Paramount. He agreed to let union members run the projectors. In 1949, Childs sold the Times Theater and building to a group of Cedar Rapids businessmen, J.D. Siegel, A.N. Gelb, Lewis Fellman, and A.W. Bass, who closed it for renovation that included a new screen. Manager Roy Metcalf booked a mix of new and second-run movies. In 1957, four manufacturing plants in Cedar Rapids bought out the house during a four-week run of Around the World in 80 Days, which had won the 1956 Oscar for Best Picture. Nine high school groups and some University of Iowa students did the same. The theater arranged to get the hit movie held over for another 4 weeks. After being closed for several weeks in 1965, the remodeled theater opened in April as the new Times 70. It had a giant screen, the city's first 70mm film projector, new sound equipment, and larger, more comfortable seats. Its first movie was a John Wayne spectacular called Circus World. In August, another Oscar winner, The Sound of Music, was shown. Admission was $2 for evening performances Sunday through Thursday, with Fridays and Saturdays costing a quarter more. By the 1970s, though, the Times Fair was alternating between second-run and R-rated movies. MK Enterprises, owned by Jim and Lynn Sparks of Des Moines, bought the property in 1982 and began operating it as an adult entertainment theater, offering XXX films, live dances, peak booths, and stag parties. When the Cedar Rapids City Council passed a zoning ordinance in July 1984 restricting the location of adult movie houses and bookstores, the Times had until July 1987 to close or relocate. The theater closed in January 1987, and a new business that rented videos moved in. In March 1992, the building was demolished and a 2,400-square-foot Arby's restaurant built in its place. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 15, 2022. For the last hour, the articles have been selected and read with a waning voice by me, Sharon Faldudo, from my kitchen table. Not sure if this is a cold or just the pollen trying to get me. We welcome your comments at any time, and you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.